Today we talk with Bert Doman about his latest technical analyst report called Gold and Silver, Opportunity of a Lifetime.
The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We always hear about the two certainties in life, you know, death and taxes. There's actually a third certainty in life, and that is that the value of your currency, no matter what currency you hold, will continue to decline. If you know that certainty exists, why not put some of your depreciating currency into an asset that is going to hold its value over thousands of years? And that is gold.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. A favorite guest of mine, David, has been Bert Doman through the years. Not just guest, but we've seen him oftentimes when you're traveling either to the Bahamas or Europe, Vegas. When you're giving conferences, Bert seems to be one of the top speakers at a lot of the conferences that you're invited to.
Well, and Bert's relationship with our family goes back many decades. We've known him for at least 30 years, probably close to 40 years, because I think my dad was very good friends with him in the 70s before I was even born. So, I mean, it's fun to connect with him, touch base with him. I've been in his home many times in California, and today we visit with him in Hawaii. And I think what I like most is the combination of fundamental and technical analysis on the economy and investment markets in the Wellington Letter. It's something that Bert does very well, blending those together, painting not only the big picture, but some pivot points in the marketplace. Sometimes we disagree and he's right. And sometimes we disagree and he's wrong, but more often than not, he's right and we're wrong. And I appreciate his perspective. We always are reading him and learning from him and wanted to extend that. He hasn't been on the commentary for a couple of years now. And I really think that our current listenership needs to know him, be exposed to the Wellington Letter and the value that that can bring on a monthly basis.
Well, and he's not really married to one position or another. I remember there were two men who had predicted a very long bear market in gold, and Bert Doman was one. In 1981, he said that we're going to have a 20-year bear market in gold, and then it'll be followed with my cyclical charting with a 30-year bull market starting in 2001. And I remember Richard Russell, who has passed away over the last year. Richard Russell said the same thing. He had predicted the bear market in gold, but he turned around and predicted the bull market. Those two men I highly respect, and actually, they were accurate on their timing. One of the things that I think is interesting that Bert is saying is he really feels the bull market in gold has restarted after the cyclical bear and that it could continue as far out as 2031. So we'll see if he's right.
Bert, it's great to have you back on the program after too long a stretch. And I want to start with the America first. This was the election mantra. The President of the United States now seems to be delivering on this in his first 100 days. What, in your opinion, are the implications, either positive or negative, of this America first position?
Well, I think it's a sea change. I compared it even before the election. I said, you know, I have a feeling he's going to win. Forget the polls. They're all totally falsified. All you have to do is look at the top people behind the polls, and you knew that they were being paid by the Clinton campaign. And so I said, you know, all you have to do is look at the audiences that he has when he gives his speech. You know, that tells you what sentiment is. He had 20,000, 30,000 people. She had 200, 300 people at her events. So anyway, that told you he was going to win. And I said, you know, if he wins, you're going to see a change, just like when Ronald Reagan got elected. And a tremendous change. Remember, Jimmy Carter had really screwed up the works and was an absolute mess. And Ronald Reagan came in. And now we're seeing the same thing with Mr. Trump, except that this time he has huge opposition. The radical left does not want to give up control over all of the institutions that they've had. And the agenda is to destroy him. So that is going to be potentially very bad for America and for everything else.
Now, he's laying out what is the equivalent of a recovery plan. I mean, if you were a restructuring guy, you would sort of say, here's where we need to cut the fat. Here's where we're going to make sure and shore up business relationships. And this turnaround plan for America, I wonder what your thoughts are about sort of implementation risk. Taking an idea to reality, in this case, is not just about project management, because as you've just noted, it appears that the president's opposition may stop at nothing to prevent him from delivering on his promises. I mean, Soros may be a part of that, but certainly there's a broader context than one person that represents opposition to implementing this plan.
Yeah, you know, the hedge fund, the billionaire you mentioned, stated in an interview with Bloomberg from Davos, he said, I want him to fail, he said, referring to the president. That's an incredible thing to say about the president of the United States. You want the president to fail? That means that America will fail and all Americans will be hurt by that. I think the plan as outlined so far is tremendous. It's exactly what we've needed. It's a plan that a successful businessman would do. He's not the only one in the world that would do this. We have been yearning for a business executive type of approach to managing the country for decades. Now we finally have one, and it seems there are people that want to destroy him. He's going about it as a businessman. He says, we have too much fat. Let's cut the fat. Let's cut expenses. Let's start negotiating with all the big industry that has been just dining at the trough here and getting all of the taxpayer money without anybody negotiating for the taxpayer on the other side. He wants to reduce regulations. He wants to reduce individual taxes. He wants to reduce corporate taxes, etc. But of course, it has to be paid for, and that's going to be the big obstacle. This is where the radical left is going to fight him. They're going to say, look at these huge deficits. And, you know, this is what they tried to do with Ronald Reagan, too. And I was fortunate enough with my wife, we had dinner with Mr. and Mrs. Reagan before he actually announced that he was going to run. And he said that the agenda has to be to put that monster on a diet. And that's what he said. And the way to do that is you do the tax cuts first, and that reduces the revenues, and then the deficits will balloon to such an extent that the opposition will have to go along with cuts and expenditures. That was his plan. Then, of course, he was criticized for the ballooning deficits in the first 2 years, but that was actually his intent. And then the Democrats had to say, yes, we have to cut expenditures and the rise in expenditures. So that was all part of the plan. We're going to have the same thing here. You know, the next time will be March when the debt ceiling will come under debate. That's going to be a tough debate. If they manage it so that the debt ceiling cannot be increased, it's going to be a problem to get tax cuts through, right? So there are many different ways to sabotage the efforts, and that's my concern.
After being largely critical of the establishment on the campaign trail, Mr. Trump has placed quite a few establishment types in his inner circle. How do you translate that?
Yes, I've done quite a bit of thinking about that. And, you know, there's some people that I think all of us would rather not have there. But on the other hand, you want to have some representatives of the establishment, especially the financial establishment, on your side so that you don't have to fight them as well. You want them to basically have a position inside the administration. You know, the old saying, keep your friends close, but keep your enemies even closer. And I think that applies.
The last 8 years, we've seen, as you are a market practitioner, we've witnessed a sharp rise in asset prices, but really very slow growth in the economy. If we flop from monetary to fiscal policy stimulus, could we now in the next 4 years have the opposite, sort of stagnation in asset prices, but a sharp rise in economic activity and growth?
Well, this is the big unknown, of course. When you take a look at corporate earnings, in the fourth quarter of last year, corporate earnings actually were lower than in the fourth quarter of 2011. That means 5 years of no earnings growth in the S&P 500. When you take a look at revenues of the Dow Jones 30, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Index, revenues right now are actually lower than in 2010. That is incredible. You never hear this on financial TV. You never hear that there has been no growth in earnings, no growth in revenues for that time, while the S&P 500 is up 87%. So there's a real disconnect here. And I'm just concerned that this balloon will be blown up to such an extent that it will eventually turn into, and it will be very easy for someone who intends to do that to crash the market. And we might see that later this year. If things get overvalued sufficiently, then there could be just a tremendous run for the hills when the plug is pulled. Right now, I see the attitude. Many of the big money managers are still reluctant to get into the market, but they're being forced to because the market is going up. But I tell you, everyone has one eye on the exits, saying, you know, when the plug is pulled, we're getting out. So you could see just a very, very massive run for the exits whenever that plug is pulled. And it wouldn't take much. And I have some ideas that I've shared with our subscribers to the Wellington Letter about what they will do to pull that plug.
I thought you'd find this humorous, but there was a gentleman being quoted in Bloomberg this morning by the name of Brent Moulton. He retired this past December from the Bureau of Labor Statistics after 32 years. And he says that right now he's concerned that the new administration may manipulate government statistics by a change in methodologies or by dropping certain statistics if Trump thought that that were politically expedient. And I wasn't sure if this was reading as a confessional or if this is just sort of reflecting his personal disappointment in the November elections. But then, you know, they bring in these academics to say, hey, you know, we're going to be flying blind. If they're going to play with the numbers, then we're going to be flying blind in terms of the economy. And I'm thinking to myself, Bert, as we've compared notes through the years, these methodologies shifted repeatedly over the last 20 or 30 years. It didn't matter who was in the Oval Office. It happened during Clinton's administration, it happened during the Bush administration, it happened during Obama. Now the BLS is concerned that maybe there's a manipulation of statistics?
Yeah, David, you know, David, we've had long discussions personally about that topic. The Department of Labor statistics are like Grimm's fairy tales. You know, they're laughable. Remember before the 2012 election, suddenly in 1 month, we had 800,000 new people being added to the payrolls, you know? And I explained in our services to our clients how they calculate that number. Basically, it was all part-time jobs, and it's the household service. They call 70,000 households in every month, and they say, have you worked? And this guy says, no, I haven't really worked this last month. They said, are you sure? Haven't you done anything? He said, well, I mowed the lawn for my father-in-law. And they said, oh, so you have work. He said, yeah, but I didn't get paid for it. He said, that doesn't matter. You don't have to be paid for it. It's still a job. Okay. So how many times did you mow the lawn? Well, about four times in a month. Oh, so you had four jobs during the month. That's counted as four jobs, although he didn't get paid for any of them. This is how our labor statistics are fudged. And if you don't believe it, just go to a page deep inside of the Department of Labor website. It explains how they calculate these numbers. But no economist ever does this. These PhD economists don't even know how these numbers are calculated, you know, because it's work. Okay, so that's what you get from our economists. When economists are making policy for the governments, you know you're going to be in trouble. This is what Mr. Trump is facing right now with this back tax, you know, the border adjustment tax. I'm sure this was fabricated by somebody who does not want Trump to succeed. You know, this is such a horrendous piece of garbage, you know, putting a 20% tax on anything that comes across our border. This is terrible. It will cause him to fail. And today we just heard that he's reconsidering that and it may not go through. I hope he will not go that route. You know? But our economic statistics here, and I've written it many times, they're as bad as those coming out of China. If you believe the economic statistics from China, you will also believe the ones out of Washington.
We've had an interesting experience the last 8-9 years, not only a massive amount of liquidity created by the central bank community. You look at what the Fed's activities have been, the growth in their balance sheet, the change in behavior that that has affected at the commercial banking level. And now you've got $2 trillion in excess reserves of depository institutions, which are held at the Fed. We've got rising rates, with the front edge of rising rates, a reversal of elements of Dodd-Frank. And I wonder if we can't, with an appreciation for how a fractional reserve banking system operates, look at this $2 trillion in excess reserves and see a path to it getting into the economy, turning a disinflationary environment to an aggressively inflationary environment quite quickly. Dodd-Frank, reserves are already there. The nature of fractional reserve banking is 8, 9, 10 to 1. And maybe there's a reason for banks to lend if you're in a rising rate environment. It's actually more profitable for them to lend. What are your thoughts in terms of a potential transition out of a disinflationary environment to one where there's greater concerns about inflation?
David, that is exactly what we addressed in our special report last week on gold. And you have your finger right on the right spot, as you normally do. You know, I've always said you're one of the smartest guys out there. And in the late 1970s, we had a situation similar to this. And I've been talking about that for the last year. I said we could get into a situation like 1978. At that point, we got a new Federal Reserve chairman. We're coming out of a 15-month bear market in the blue chip stocks. And the new Fed chairman said, I'm not going to fight rising inflation with tight money. I'm going to do it with interest rate policy. And that for us was the green light for a big bull market in the precious metals and in stocks. It was totally contrary to what Wall Street was saying, because Wall Street always says rising interest rates and rising inflation are bad for stocks. We said that the rising inflation will be bullish for stocks because stocks will become an inflation hedge, because companies can raise prices in the marketplace. What you said is exactly what could happen, is that these tremendous reserves in our banking system, the Fed has a balance sheet of over $4 trillion right now, and that money is just sitting there. You know, gives it to the banks, and the banks send it back to the Fed as reserves and let it sit there because they're not making loans. But once those reserves, you know, by a factor of about 10 to 1, you mentioned $2 trillion. Let's say it's $2 trillion of bank reserves. You multiply that by 10, you can have potentially $20 trillion of loans being made. Of course, it won't be that much, but you know, even if a couple of trillion dollars of loans are made, this economy could really start humming and prices would rise. And especially if the America First program goes through, forcing U.S. companies to get manufacturing back into the U.S. at much higher cost, prices are going to have to rise substantially. The only thing that will prevent prices from rising is if the consumer doesn't have enough spending power. But if banks start lending again to individuals, that will be resolved. So we could see just a big inflationary binge in the economy, and that would totally change the ball game for investors of the last 7 years. You have to be ready for that, and it would open up some fantastic opportunities. You know, I started my business in 1977, and when we predicted in 1978 what was going to happen, it really launched the business. And we had 2 years of a tremendous bull market into precious metals. And then, of course, Paul Volcker came in and we said, that's it. He's going to actually tighten money. And tight money brings you then the opposite. That's the sobering up period. And then we had the big crash, the big recession, et cetera. And, you know, we even said it when gold broke through 694 to the downside. We said, that's it. We're going into a 20-year bear market in gold. People didn't want to believe it was 20 years, but our cycle study said 20-year bear market. It's going to be followed by a 30-year bull market. It's interesting. We're right now in that 30-year period for the bull market, and that's what makes us bullish on gold and silver.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we talked a little bit about the excess reserves of depository institutions. And if that does get into the economy, $1-2 trillion, let alone 5 or 10 or 20, which, as you say, is unlikely. But we're talking about an increase in the velocity of money. And that creates a bit of demand pull inflation, too much money chasing too few goods. Could see wages rise. We might also get a little bit of cost push inflation. I wonder, with that as a backdrop, we already know the Fed's behind the curve. We know the Fed's behind the curve. But if they shift from their 8-year war footing against deflation, tactically pivot and start addressing an inflation surprise, what is the impact to asset prices? Because, I mean, it may be different than 1977-78 is the amount of leverage that's in the system. You look at the amount of debt that's in the system, you start raising rates, and you're talking about balance sheet. I don't know if it's impairment, but it certainly is going to take corporations a lot more in terms of current cash flow if they're paying higher and higher rates.
Yes, and that is, of course, the downside. And in 1980, you know, when everything started crashing down, we had a 21.5% prime rate in December of 1980. and inflation was around 15%. So that was incredible. So then Paul Volcker crunched it down, started fighting inflation, and then, of course, the whole ball game of participating in the benefits, let's call it that, for speculators of inflation reversed. This is exactly the reason why I say you cannot be a buy and hold investor right now, perhaps in precious metals, but not in stocks. So the downside here is, of course, if you have rising inflation and rising interest rates by the Fed, that means that bond prices will have a tough time. In 1978, we predicted that Treasury bonds would lose 40 to 50% of their value. And that was considered crazy. The chief economist of Goldman Sachs, in fact, in a seminar that he held here where I lived, he said that's ludicrous. And it happened. The Treasury bonds went down 44%. And our subscribers really benefited from them because we showed them how to make a lot of money out of that. So we could see this again. As long as inflation keeps on rising and as long as money is available, that higher inflation will not bother anything. In fact, it will fuel speculation. The thing that you want to look for then is when they actually start tightening money. And people have to differentiate between higher interest rates and tight money. Most economists say rising interest rates, it's tighter money. No, it's not at all. There is a huge difference. If interest rates rise because of rising inflation, but money is available, credit is available, it actually fuels the speculation. But when tight money starts, then, of course, assets, which includes a stock, are sold in order to get cash because no one has cash. Everybody is loaned up to the gills. And that's when things reverse. And we've always made huge money for our subscribers in bear markets. Those are the greatest opportunities because nobody's prepared for it. If you're one of the few that is prepared for it, you can make so much money. I remember in 1980 to 1982, we had put options on all of the major gold mining stocks. And at the end, the put options were priced higher than the stocks themselves, you know? But here we had from 77 to 1980, we were long the mining stocks. We had the call options, et cetera. We made lots of money, but then we made the turn. You have to know when the turn occurs. That's the essential thing. You cannot be locked into your investments. You cannot be a crusader for the cause.
You know, you asked the question in your recent special report, gold and silver, the opportunity of a lifetime. And that's a question. How do you answer that? I mean, I hear you saying that we may be, you know, 15 years into a 30-year bull market. Are we comfortable saying that a cyclical bear is behind us and we're back to the secular bull trend?
I still have a question mark on that because we don't have a key to looking into the future. But just using technical analysis, I made the case in that report, and actually it started a year ago, and it was our first piece on this, is that look at these charts. It could be that the cyclical bear market, which was from 2011 to 2015, is over. The secular, as you know, is a very long-term market, bull market that started in 2001. And look at this, how cycles can work. In 1981, we said a 20-year bear market in gold. And it turned out this time, you know, cycles sometimes vary. If you say it's a 20-year cycle, it may be 18 or 22 years. But this time it was right on the button. It was 2001 when the new bull market in gold was launched. So the secular bull market, if it's really going to be 30 years, should last until about 2031, something like that. So we still have some good time. And now, what I also said in 1981 was, I have no idea what caused a 30-year bull market in gold, you know? But this is what cycle studies going back several hundred years showed us. And now we know it's this huge $21 trillion of additional reserves have been created by the world's major central banks, by the 10 top banks. This $21 trillion. This is huge. You know, the world has never seen such a monetary experiment ever. And it can only lead to a total destruction of the value of currencies. And this is why we're now seeing this attempt of the major central banks and governments and so on to do away with currency totally and give us all digital currency. So everything has to go through digital mechanisms, which the government can shut off anytime they want to. They want to get rid of your currency in your pockets. One experiment was recently conducted in India when they called in currency notes. 86% of the currency in circulation suddenly disappeared. And that experiment was actually, as we know now, it wasn't advertised that way, but as we know now, that was hatched in Washington, D.C. Okay, so they're already experimenting with doing away with currencies. Okay, now gold, of course, in the U.S. and the EU, etc., they can easily penalize you for holding gold. Okay, they don't have to even prohibit gold ownership. They can just say there's going to be an 80% tax on any profits that you make. And suddenly the gold bull market is over. They can do this. But the other countries may not do that, like China and Russia. Okay, China really wants to accumulate as much gold as they can. And not only the government, they want people to own gold. They're smart. They're very smart over there. And I think they're looking over the long term. They say this cannot end well, and currency eventually is going to be worthless. So they want to own the gold.
Well, so in the language of secular markets and cyclical markets, I guess we are comfortable concluding that the evidence is building, and we don't have it definite, but the evidence is building that that period of 2011 to 2015 was an interim decline in the larger context of a major move higher. Maybe you could speak to what any secular trend in any market looks like. When you look at a secular trend, regardless of the asset in question, how does the market behave? What does that look like as you move into sort of a last half, the last third of a major secular trend?
You look at chart formations, you know, charts repeat and chart patterns. And with gold, we had that first phase, I call it, of the secular bull market, would it be from 2001 to 2011, 10 years. Then we had the five-year decline, which was a cyclical bear market. Then we saw the bottom, and that was a 50% retracement of that first rise. The 50% retracement in technical analysis is normal in any bull market, okay? Now, if it would have gone deeper, and especially if it would have gone deeper than the 61.8% Fibonacci retracement, then you would have said, okay, the secular bull market is over, it's done for, and we're going to go back down to the 2001 lows. But it didn't happen. It held to 50% and then started rising. And the pattern that we now have, we noted this 1 year ago, the pattern that we now have confirms everything that we said a year ago. And we're now seeing a beautiful inverse head and shoulder pattern, which is bullish, forming on the long term, the very long term chart of gold. If we see a breakout now above about 1435 on gold, it would complete that pattern. And that means that the 1930 level in gold would be challenged. And once we're above that, just by technical measurements on the chart, you would be looking for about $2,700 on gold. That's not a forecast. I'm just talking from a strictly gold chart pattern analysis of what can happen. So this is what we're looking for. And in technical analysis, you always want the patterns to confirm your prior analysis. Once there's a divergence, you say, hey, wait a minute, this should not have happened if we really think this was a bottom. And then you know, okay, something has happened to change it. So you never want to get locked in. You want to always look for additional confirmations of what you are looking for. And that's the only way to stay out of trouble and to make money in a long-term trend. So right now, we have to look at the 1430, 1435 area, and we also look at the mining stocks. The mining stocks are actually looking much better than the metals themselves.
Which is usually, the opposite is also the case. When you're in a bear trend, the mining stocks are that much worse. So if the mining stocks are improving and performing better, you've got something of a confirmation there. What does it mean to you when the bullish consensus on gold hits a 14-year low?
Yeah, you know, the bullish consensus, when there's so few bulls out there, it's very bullish for a market, any market. And we had that chart in a special report last week where it showed that this was early 2016. There were almost no bulls amongst the big speculators. Well, the big speculators were short. And when the big speculators are usually wrong at important turns. And so if there are no bulls, then they're all bearish. And that means that you want to be bullish. You want to be on the other side. We always want to be on the side where the big speculators are not. You know, the unpopular side. You know, we call it the winning minority.
You know, I started traveling with my dad when I was about 3 years old, and I probably heard this quote 1,000 times. If I heard it once, I heard it 1,000, maybe 10,000 times, that the majority is always wrong. And I mean, I tell you over and over and over again, and maybe my dad wanted to impress that upon me as I was heading into junior high and high school that I didn't need to follow the crowd, or, you know, I was probably trying to figure out why he said this all the time. But, you know, the bullish consensus, what you just said, the little quote that my dad always raised me with, the majority is always wrong. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the majority of investors are unwilling to question a trend, or unwilling to step back from history and say, okay, I see that we're at this point and we should either see a reversal or the market's at an extreme or what have you? What do you think about investor psychology being locked in at this point?
You know, it's human nature. It's the herding instinct. We all feel more comfortable when we're part of a group and everybody has the same opinion. We say, wow, everybody here thinks the way I do. It must be a good idea. No, if everybody thinks the same way that you do, it must be a very bad idea. And that's how it usually works. Now, in the investment markets, that's even amplified because money is involved. And in the investment markets, if everybody's bullish, it means that all the money has already gone in there. All the money has already gone in there. You can't find anybody who's not in it. So that means that the next phase is only when one little negative thing starts arising, but some people start selling. And then that selling gets lower prices. And that gets more people selling. And this is how a bear market starts. And then fewer and fewer people are interested in buying the thing. They're more interested in selling. And this is the cycle of human emotions. And this is what makes bull markets and bear markets. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the corporate earnings and corporate revenues and all of these things that financial TV and Wall Street wants you to believe in. You know, I mean, it is so comical when you hear these earnings reports from corporations. And on the financial TV, they don't tell you how that earnings report compared with 1 year ago. So they don't even let you know if that was better than a year ago or worse than a year ago. No, they tell you if it beat estimates. Estimates. Well, who makes the estimates? It's Wall Street, the greatest manipulators of all. Okay? If they want most companies to beat estimates, they just put their estimates lower than they think they're going to be. And then everybody beats the estimates. And then what you see on financial TVs, wow, 70% of the companies reporting so far beat estimates. Well, estimates are totally irrelevant.
That's right. Well, you know, when you describe gold as a hedge against a loss of confidence in a currency, we have this already to some degree overseas. Maybe King Dollar stays King Dollar a lot longer. I don't know. But demand overseas, demand for gold, that is, seems to reflect a diminishment in enthusiasm for other currencies. How do you conceptualize a decline in currency values, having a position in gold as an offset, and also balancing out what you might see in terms of behavior in the stock market? Is it necessarily negative for stocks? Is it positive on the front end, negative, you know, as time goes on? Help us wrap our minds around that.
Gold is not a crisis hedge. It's not a fear hedge and all of these other things that you always hear. In my opinion, gold is only a hedge against declining purchasing power of the currency. That's what it is. And when you take a look, you know, I was just at the shopping center and a little cup of ice cream, $7. I can't believe this. I remember when it was a nickel, you know, and this really tells you what has happened to the purchasing power of the dollar. Okay. Now, other countries have had even a greater reduction in the purchasing power of their currency. And this is what it all comes down to. You know, we always hear about the two certainties in life, you know, death and taxes. There's actually a third certainty in life, and that is that the value of your currency, no matter what currency you hold, will continue to decline. Okay? That is a certainty. If you know that certainty exists, why not put some of your depreciating currency into an asset that is going to hold its value over thousands of years? And that is gold. You know, gold has done that. And that doesn't mean you have to have 50 or 100% of your assets in gold. No, but it's smart to diversify. It is really smart to diversify. You want some real assets in this next go around. This is going to be the big one. All that money, and you said it initially in this interview, when the reserves that is currently stuck at the Federal Reserve, the bank reserves, when they are being used for loans. You know, first you get the kick in the economy, it's going to really do well. Then you get the inflation. And then you finally eventually get to the point where the central bank starts saying, ooh, too much inflation, we got to tighten money. And that's when everything starts tumbling down. And that includes precious metals at that time. But in 2008, during that crisis, you know, we predicted that crisis. I even wrote a book in 2007, said the prelude to meltdown. And I said, 2008 is going to see a global financial crisis. Nobody wanted to believe it. Okay, so the book obviously was not a bestseller. But we saw the precious metals get hit just as hard as the stock market, and oil and everything came tumbling down. Then look at the recovery that gold and silver had after that. So the first reaction is everybody sells everything just to get cash because nobody has any. Everybody just has a lot of loans outstanding and they need the cash. Then everything is sold. The second phase is when the big smart money goes and picks up the bargain. And in this case, they were picking up gold. And this is what will happen the next time around, too, in my opinion, because the next financial disaster is going to cause the central banks of the world to just create so much confetti, otherwise known as currency, that, you know, people say, this can't be good. We got to diversify. We have to buy some gold. We have to buy some silver. And I think that is where you're really going to be making the money.
When I think about Wall Street and their ability to increase prices in an inflationary context, they can. I think what they ultimately butt up against is a change in investor behavior or consumer behavior, really. And I experienced it this last week. I looked at, for the first time in a long time, the size of a Girl Scout cookie box. You probably have them out in your neighborhood. This is the season. They're out in force. It's a smaller box, and the boxes are a dollar more expensive than they were last year.
How much are they now?
I think it was $4 a box instead of three, and it's a smaller box. And I looked at that and I thought, I mean, I love Thin Mints, but I don't love them that much. And so it didn't happen. I changed my behavior. Can I afford $4? Sure. But do I love junk food that much? No, I was actually offended by the sticker shock, right? So it changed consumer behavior, at least for me. I don't know how many other people it does. I'm not trying to, you know, discourage you from buying Girl Scout cookies. I think you should, but it just seems that there's a change in behavior. You know, one of the other changes in behavior that we saw 2008, 2009, you mentioned smart money moving to gold in 2008, 2009, picking it up at bargain prices. We now have an awareness of counterparty risk and counterparty concerns that was not really out there prior to this most recent crisis. So you add counterparty concerns to inflation concerns, you know, where people decide to own the metal in order to just get out of the banking system. What are the dynamics that you think are possible in the gold market where, again, you've got sophisticated money, large money that wants to come in and own gold by the ton, and the man in the street who doesn't really like the banking system? It seems to me that when you get to the end of a bull market, that's when you see an increase in the rate of change and the potential for parabolic moves. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think so at all. But the problem that I see in all of this is what the governments will do to prevent people from going to gold as an alternative to money. And whether it's currency, you know, that they have to print, or whether it's digital money, you know, throughout the ages, thousands of years, governments debased their currencies, have imposed penalties on their population for trying to use alternatives to the phony money they printed or coined, you know. I mean, this included, even in some countries a few thousand years ago, a death penalty if you accepted the money of your neighboring country, which might have a higher gold content than the stuff that your own government was giving you. So, you know, you're going to be fighting the powers of government and the central banks, and we got to figure out a way to prevent that. That's why I, as a U.S. citizen, like the mining stocks as well, because, you know, they're not going to prohibit you from holding mining stocks, and they're probably not going to tax it differently than industrial stocks. So this is a dilemma that investors will face, obviously. So for foreign investors that can have their gold somewhere else, stored especially, that is an advantage. They can go to gold and probably not have those concerns.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's a problem that has to be solved. The desperate reach of government under desperate circumstances may put penalty pressure on current investors, and something that has to be borne in mind. It's certainly our desire to do everything that we can legislatively to ensure that gold ownership is possible. And this administration, perhaps more than any other, would be open to that, I think. You look at their position sort of against the Fed, and maybe even the demand for an audit of the Fed, and I think you might have a friendly audience to legislation that protects that right indefinitely, or at least until it's overturned.
David, you're so right in what you said, because when you listen closely to what President Trump says, either as a candidate or now that he's president, he knows what is really happening behind the scenes. He is totally aware. And I cannot say that about other presidents that we've had in the last 20 years or so. He is totally aware. And that's why he is dangerous to the what Greenwald, the journalist, and some others call the deep state. You know, somebody that knows as much as Trump is dangerous to these people. But hopefully he will be able to accomplish what others have not been able to accomplish. Ronald Reagan, he went ahead and showed him that with the backing of Americans, he was able to overcome this entrenched establishment. And, of course, there was an assassination attempt, but it failed. But he had the courage. Remember when he fired all the air traffic controllers? Nobody thought that was possible. But he did, because they violated federal law by striking. And maybe President Trump will be able to do the same thing in ousting the people that have now criminally released tapped phone calls of his own phone calls with the Prime Minister of Australia, the President of Mexico, the telephone conversation of his National Security Advisor. They were tapped. That's criminal. That's criminal. And not only were they tapped, they were transcribed and then released to the media. That's another criminal violation. Mainstream media says nothing about that. This is incredible. These leaks are coming from the intelligence community or certain members of the intelligence community. So that shows you how far they will go to destroy this president.
Well, Bert, thank you for, through the years, recommending people consider our company if they want to own physical metals. We appreciate that. We appreciate the relationship that we've had going back decades, multiple generations. And I would really encourage folks to get a hold of your special report in the Wellington Letter, Gold and Silver, Opportunity of a Lifetime. What's the best way for them to request that or to subscribe to the Wellington Letter?
The best thing that has all the information would be to go to our website, which is Doman Capital, D as in David, O-H, M as in Mary, E, N as in Nancy, capital.com. And all the information about our services. We also have subscription services for short-term traders that want to trade. They're doing very well. At times we are both long and short. We buy the strongest stocks. We short the weakest ones. Today's environment, that's a pretty good idea. David, it's always really enjoyable talking with you because, you know, you're the son of an old friend of mine that I knew since the 1970s, and I always respected your knowledge of the markets, and you know I've told you that in person. And by the way, you are the only company that I ever mentioned to someone when they asked me, where can I buy gold and silver coins? Anyway, it's always great to speak with you, and glad we had this opportunity. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, hey, great to hear your voice. We haven't spoken as frequently as you should have in recent years, and I hope we can fix that. So look forward to seeing you soon. Best regards to everyone in your family, and look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you very much, David.
Thanks for listening to today's McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. We'll see you next Wednesday. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at ICAGold. For our latest updates and market thoughts. And you can follow David at David McIlvaney. That's DavidMcAlvaney. And if you want to learn more about us and what we do, visit us online at McIlvaney.com. Or if you have questions about precious metals investing recommendations, give us a call at 800-525-9556. Thanks for listening.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.